Welcome to episode 61, the Roger Maris edition, I guess, of the Golf Talk podcast brought to you by thesamtrap.com. This is the U.S. Open edition, the post-U.S. Open edition. This is Eric Barzeski, of course, and joining me this week we have Jeff Smith in Washington. Hello.
Hello.
And Jack Waddell in New Jersey.
Greetings.
Hello, everyone listening. We're going to start off, of course, with and talk about pretty much only the U.S. Open. Of course, Angel Cabrera, the winner, three-time European Tour winner, but no PGA Tour wins. Really kind of a guy who plays mostly in Europe in a couple of the European Tour events and a couple of the WGC events. We, of course, saw him in the President's Cup last time that was played, but really kind of an unknown guy. But grew up down the street from Eduardo Romero, who's had a successful Champions Tour career, nicknamed El Pato, or the Duck.
Well, I think it's really cool that the Duck beat the Tiger, if nothing else in nicknames.
Yeah, if anything, we know that these birds can be pretty ornery sometimes. And yeah, obviously this was an unexpected victory for probably all of us. I mean, who could have seen Cabrera being the guy to kind of, you know, duck it out?
Well, Cabrera kind of had it seemed to me, and I was there, so I didn't get to watch the TV coverage, so I'm relying on you guys for that kind of commentary, but it seemed to me that he was very much gung-ho and hitting the driver a lot and all over the place and, you know, scraping together a lot of birdies, but a lot of bogeys to go with it. It worked for him. He shot the only two rounds in the 60s of anybody of the week, including on Sunday, so it worked for him. But is that how he played?
Well, I think it was. I think you have to look at this tournament and say that he won the tournament as opposed to Tiger Woods losing the tournament. I mean, you know, you can debate that.
There was a bit of both, I think. But did he play aggressively is what I'm asking. Did he hit a lot of drivers? And I mean, he certainly hit a driver on 9 and then left himself a sandwich on Friday to eliminate the plus 11s.
Well, I think the USGA failed in their mission to thwart the bomber. Basically, because that is exactly what he is.
Well, I don't know if that's the mission. I think, you know, if you can hit a driver and hit it straight enough times, then you can get rewarded with birdies. But he certainly paid the price with a number of bogeys. He's the only player, I think, that didn't double bogey anything of the week.
I think it's a case of, here's a guy who actually played the tournament as it was supposed to be played. I don't think it was a case of him laying up or choosing less club on any particular hole. I read on one of the blogs following the tournament that he was sucking on his cigarettes pretty hard, so I think he was kind of nervous, but he just happened to be the guy to just get it done.
But that's something I talked about with Jack. You know, cigarettes, we talk about, you know, substances and performance enhancing whatevers and so on. Cigarettes calm you down and help you focus, supposedly. Should cigarettes be disallowed? I mean, you know, you could see players stick it on a nicotine patch if it helps calm them down.
I can say that they are indeed a performance enhancing drug.
Right. So, I mean, seriously, I mean, Tiger's not going to smoke, but, you know, I mean, you could put a nicotine patch, like I was saying, on, and, you know, some of the players could do that. I mean, Jack and Arnie did it back in the day. I mean, a lot of players have smoked. Not too many do it on the course nowadays.
It's just so bad looking, among other things. I mean, it is disgusting. But I, at the same time, I loved Angel's quote about, you know, I don't need a psychologist, I smoke. Which is true.
All right. Well, that's certainly one way to look at it. So perhaps nicotine will be on a banned list of substances at some point, but we'll see. I don't know. Tiger Woods, of course, did not win. One could argue that his 69 on Saturday was the absolute worst 69 he's ever shot. Hit 17 greens, bogeyed the last hole, the only hole he didn't hit the green on. Missed, you know, 10 putts by a combined total of a foot and a half or so. Had 35 putts and shot 69 and hit 17 greens. They weren't long. I mean, he had 10 footers, he had 15 footers a lot of the day. So the worst 69 he could have shot, kind of scraped it around to a 72 on Sunday, including a double bogey. He flubbed a chip on 3. He bladed it across the green on 17. Supposedly there was a rock there, but how much did Tiger lose the tournament, and should he have won? I mean, he seems a little loose this year. I mean, he played about like he did on Sunday at the Masters, it seemed to me. Again, I didn't watch the coverage because I was there, but just a little loose in enough places. Missed the green with a wedge on 11.
Yeah, it was really an unfortunate round for him. His only double bogey actually came in the final round, so that was a real stumble for him. It was too bad. I mean, he had two bad holes, you know, the whole day. One birdie. His 74 on Friday was one that he could look back to and say, hey, I could have shot a better round.
Angel Cabrera, on the other hand, missed a five footer on 13, though, didn't he? I mean, he missed. He left a lot of shots on the golf course on the weekend. He could have run away with the thing, honestly. I mean, but he didn't.
Well, yes, he could have. And I think that's the most remarkable thing about Woods, is that even when he's playing so poorly for him, and he was this entire Open, I thought. I mean, he just never got the putter going. He had no short game, not his usual short game, at any rate. But the most remarkable thing is when he's playing that poorly for him, he still finishes second. I mean, it's unfathomable to me how good he is, and when he plays that badly, he can still contend.
Well, and he seems to play that badly coming from behind. He's still, obviously, much was made of this, but he still hasn't won a major coming from behind, and he was only, after one hole, he was tied for the lead, so it's not like he was really behind.
Well, and he also had the lead for a short time, right? Early in the round.
But just like he did at the Masters. One time is an anomaly. Two times is the start of a pattern.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, 0 for 29 is more than a pattern.
Right. But, some of those, of course, was way back.
You know, and I think, you know, something he said in the post-round press conference was interesting, and that he said, you know, I really have to rethink my strategy on this. And I think he does. I think that in this last round, he just wasn't aggressive enough. I mean, he needed a little of Mickelson in himself. You know, in the past, he's been able to outlast the field just through his excellence.
Well, see, he's been able to grind out pars, but, you know, Angel shot a 69. So, again, a lot of credit to Angel. He probably wasn't counting on someone going out and shooting subpar among the leaders.
Well, exactly. And that's something I haven't heard from a lot of the commentators. Angel shot 69, and he shot 72. Angel, on the last day, actually beat him by 3 shots. Now, and maybe a more aggressive approach on his part might have been warranted, and it's maybe something we'll see in the future.
Right. They moved the tees up on 14. He could have attempted to drive the green there. Instead, hit a poor wedge and left himself like 22 feet for birdie to an accessible hole. I thought it was right where we could see it. Just loose at the wrong times. Loose bunker shots on 14, again, with the loose wedge into the green. You know, one birdie in the final 32 holes of the U.S. Open. When you mix in a couple bogeys and a double, it's not going to get it done.
An interesting comparison for me is the difference between the two scorecards. You look at Angel Cabrera's scorecard, you see
up
a lot
down,
more birdies, a lot more bogeys. Tiger, a lot more pars. And so, you know, you could see in Angel perhaps his gamble paying off, and Tiger Woods just played steadier the whole week. But obviously, I think a little more aggressive play would have paid off for Tiger on the final day, and that's something maybe he's learning in that come from behind position.
Yep, he's used to holding on to a lead and not gaining and enlarging one on the final day.
I agree. You know, given his arsenal, given his skill, given his ultimate skill, you know, sometimes I think in the past, he's won a lot of tournaments by playing defensively, and it's worked. But there comes a time when defensive puts more pressure on your short game than you really can bear. And watching that last round yesterday, it seemed to me the chips and the sand shots and the leaves he left himself around the green, trying to play conservatively, put ultimately more pressure on himself than had he just, you know, flat out gone for it.
Right.
I frankly think Keurig's drive on 17, which everybody thinks was stupid, was actually a better play, and that he was being aggressive under pressure.
Well, we'll talk about Keurig in a bit, and I have something to say on that. But yeah, I think certainly the part about being aggressive is true. Tiger's aggressive usually, you know, the first 3 days of a tournament to get his lead. I don't think he knows what to do when he doesn't have the lead on Sunday. And that bears out in the 0 for 29 part. So
I agree. I think he hasn't learned that lesson yet. Maybe now he has.
Maybe now he has, yeah. We'll be right back with more on the U.S. Open after this message from Titleist. Stay tuned.
7 years ago in Las Vegas, Nevada, the Titleist Pro V1 made its professional debut.
I won with it the first time I put it in play.
It was an instant phenomenon. Number one on every worldwide professional tour. Number one with PGA professionals, with collegiate players, top amateurs, men, women, and juniors.
Seems like everybody plays a Pro V1.
The Pro V1 became the uncontested standard of performance. And best-selling ball and golf shops everywhere.
It's my number one seller, by far.
Nothing else comes close.
Now there's an all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X.
I won the first time I put it in play.
Pro V1X does what I wanted to do.
The Pro V1X gives me better distance control.
I love the new alignment line.
It gives me more confidence.
The new Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X. Better than ever.
And welcome back. Before the break, we were talking about Jim Furyk and his play on 17. Jack, you said you agreed with his decision to use pull driver on the 17th hole, the short par 4, of course. I'm not so sure, just because Jim Furyk's strengths are wedge game and putting. You know, in light of that, you know, one could argue, I think, that it's almost more aggressive to put a wedge in his hands than to ask him to hit a green with a driver and rely on a short game, God knows what kind of lie.
You know, yeah, you're right in some respects, but on the other hand, you have to climb inside the mind of the guy who's playing. And in that situation, I think, you know, even after the round, he said it was the right play. He just didn't pull it off. I agree with some of the commentators who said he didn't take into account the adrenaline rush and the strength, you know, how far he was going to possibly hit that drive because he hit it much further than he thought. So, you know, but I got to go with him. I mean, he's a real competitor, and if that was the play that he thought was the right one, you know, it was the right one.
Yeah, well, how about his shot into 18? I was positioned in the grandstands, and all we know is that we heard an extra loud crack of the ball. It was much louder than most of the other shots, and then we see him immediately, like, drop the club and, like, oh my God. So we were looking everywhere for the ball, and then we see it hit about pin high, hard and pretty fast. We were surprised it stayed on the green, but then his putt never even had its prayer. Did he blade it? What did he do there?
I think he bladed it.
Because he had, what do you have in, like a 6 or 7 iron?
Yeah, exactly. And so, I think, you know, for a guy to react like that and drop the club on top of his head, he knew immediately he hadn't hit it as he wanted to. I think that's right up there with last year's, you know, missed putt at the U.S. Open that cost him. I think it was that shot, you know, with a 6 or 7 iron, he had a chance to get it within birdie range.
Oh, yeah.
He's such a good iron player. And I think even more than the drive on 17 was the real faux pas.
We saw a lot of shots get very close to the 18th hole. We saw very few putts made. Like, it was a very tricky pin position to make putt. Everyone that putted, for example, Tiger's putt that he had to tie, left it exactly where Tiger left it. It was a very tricky pin position to putt to, but a lot of guys were getting it close. They'd hit it into that slope, it would take a hop up, and it would sit there 10 feet underneath the hole, or 10 right. feet past the hole. So not a hard pin position to get close to. A lot of green in front and so on. So really just a poor attempt. Did he choke, or was it just a bad swing?
Well, it was obviously for you know, the way that he reacted to that, I think he put a bad swing on it. And you said that you saw the ball come in low. Well, that's probably a good indication. And he just got away with something there. And Furyk, I think, has got to be frustrated at this point. I mean, he's a U.S. Open winner himself. He hasn't had great success in the last couple of years. And I think he's getting pretty hungry and probably a little frustrated. Maybe even what you saw when he took driver to try to drive the green is maybe a little uncharacteristic and trying to force issues a little bit. And so, you know, unfortunate we didn't see him play a little better there.
All right. Well, there were other contenders, of course, Aaron Baddeley, Stephen Ames, Steve Stricker was in it for a while. Bubba Watson, of course, was in it playing, you know, alongside or just behind Angel Cabrera, just behind, actually. And a lot of guys were in it. Of course, Aaron Baddeley starts off with triple. Stephen Ames, Jeff's favorite buddy, was leading for a while.
Not
before he double bogeyed 7th hole, I believe, and then fell apart after that. Mr. Grinney himself. And did they choke? Did they just have a bad day? Did Oakmont just catch up to them? It doesn't take much to ruin your chances at a U.S. Open. I mean, Aaron Baddeley's took about 10 minutes.
Well, the added pressure of the Open, I think that just did it. And some errant shots, a little extra pressure. You tighten up a little bit and things just don't go your way. And the thing of it is if you don't place the ball, you're smoked.
Well, anybody who's ever competed seriously in a serious event, serious trophy event, seeing Aaron Baddeley play the first hole, knows exactly what was happening in the pit of his stomach. That was an immediate and tragic and unwatchable choke.
And it's the first hole.
And that's just what it was. Yeah, exactly. So and now the other guys, you know, Stricker and Ames and all the other guys who fired and fell back, I can't really, even watching TV, I couldn't tell if it was a choke. You know, that course was just so hard that if you weren't on every aspect of your game, you know, it was going to get you.
Right.
And I think that's what made Furyk and Woods' contention in the end against a guy who was just shooting basically lights out all the more remarkable.
Yeah, and he said he was nervous. On 17, Angel Cabrera admitted to being nervous, and then getting back to the nicotine thing, he pulls out a cigarette on 18T and smokes his drive down the middle. No pun intended. So, interesting. But, you know, the thing with Baddeley, I was thinking to myself, I'm like, hey, the sports psychologist would say, hey, you're tied for the lead with 17 holes to go in the U.S. Open. You got your bad hole for the day out of the way. Play golf. You know, it's so, but obviously much tougher to do than to say. So,
Yeah. Well, the kind of anticipation that he must have been dealing with all night. Obviously, a lot of people were thinking that that was going to be a lot of pressure on him, and his final round, 80 really shows what was happening in his mind.
Yeah, so had Aaron Baddeley won, he would have been the only 20-year-old with a major victory to his credit, which is...
Which was kind of what I was rooting for him. I'm rooting kind of to see the next generation step it up.
Aaron Baddeley's a member of the God Squad on the PGA Tour, not to take this, go into this too long, but I was curious if anybody asked him if God was not looking out for him today, since that,
well, I think he knows
that, that group tends to give credit to God for looking out for them when they win. What about when they lose?
Well, that doesn't happen so often, does it?
No. So, God was kind of stiffed you today, huh?
Finished last. I really felt God was with me.
The course. I was there. Got to see how the course was set up. The only thing, honestly, that I would change, because I thought the USGA did a great job setting up the firmness. Friday was the touchy day. Friday, the greens were a little firm. The weekend, they allowed for some scoring. They allowed for shots to hit when struck from the fairway and stop. You know, and I was surprised, actually, how soft the greens were. It sounds weird to say that about a U.S. Open course, but I was surprised. I expected balls to be bouncing like cement, and there was nothing like that. The greens were softer than some of the muni courses that I've played, honestly. So I was surprised. I was also surprised to see what 23 to 40 yard wide fairways look like. I will say that they're probably wider, truthfully, than most places people play, because most places people play have a single row of fairway sprinklers that only go out 24 yards or so, you know, 12 in each direction. So that's the width of most places' fairways, honestly. The fancy rich courses, I mean, when you compare the U.S. Open course to Muirfield Village with, you know, 50 or 60 yard wide fairways in some places, yes, it's narrower. But I think for most average golfers, the U.S. Open courses look pretty wide for fairways, being totally truthful and honest there. The only thing that I would have changed about Oakmont would be to take both layers of the actual rough down an inch to allow for people to play towards the green, albeit without any control over the ball, spin-wise. You know, the wedge out of the rough is just, it's stupid, it's boring, it's whatever. It takes away the impossible recovery shot pulled off because the golfer is somehow able to judge how a ball will bounce and react without spin or control. So that's the only change I would make. How did it look on TV?
Well, I think what you're saying mirrors a lot of what I heard in post-round comments from even those who are whining about the course, is that, you know, they're getting into the rough, even a foot, you know, missing a foot, which means they've missed the center of the fairway by 13 yards or something.
There aren't too many fairways that are only that thin.
You know, but still, you know, missing by just foot into that deep stuff was a penalty shot, basically.
Right.
More often than not. And that was the line I heard in the post-round interviews. And, you know, they might have a point there. You know, my home course, even with 2.5, 3-inch rough, I don't know what the guy is doing to fertilize that stuff or mow it or whatever, but a ball goes down and, you know, the grass isn't much higher than the ball, but the ball is right at the bottom and you've got, you know, nothing left but a wedge.
Right.
Or, you know, an 8-iron if you're brave.
It, to me, it looked like some nasty, hairy stuff. I mean, how do you get out of that? You know, for as, Eric, you were there, you saw it firsthand. For as easy as the course may have been in terms of generosity of fairways, you know, we still had a winner come in at 5 over. That was higher than any of us predicted,
right,
in our predictions. And so I just think
a lot of that
rough
was the greens, I think, too. I mean,
there are placements.
Well, I think they had the greens under control.
The greens are in great shape. I just think they're undulating. And if you missed in the wrong spot by 5 yards, you had a 40-foot putt. There were no marginal shots that ended up as a birdie. None. Absolutely none.
Well, how many, you know, watching television, how many shots did we see hit? Even with shot to 18. Hit pin high. And you know, in a normal world of golf,
Tiger carried the ball. Tiger carried the ball, honestly. He carried it. First of all, he's coming out of the first cut of rough, the intermediate cut. He carried the ball two yards too far. He lands it 6 feet shorter, hits more into that upslope, and he has a 5-foot putt.
Right.
Honestly,
now, you know, what margin of error is the USGA looking for to define a great shot?
Well, if he had come he could have come up, you know, anywhere from 2 yards to 5 yards short of that, though. Or he could have played a little more left and had a flatter area. There were some places. I mean, you could get to that pin. We saw a lot of shots that day. But some of the other pins on the course, you just couldn't get close to. You saw Baddeley on 10. Wood stuck it close, and I think he birdied 10 on Sunday. But Baddeley's shot wasn't that much different than Tiger's. He landed at 10 feet farther, and he rolled it off the back of the green or something. So just very small margins for error on the greens. And that's why I'm saying the greens, I think, were whatever. That's why, I mean, at Oakmont anyway, and just like Pinehurst perhaps too, the rough does not need to be very long to exact a penalty because the greens aren't just flat, boring green. You know, you can't just bounce the ball onto the green and have a reasonable birdie putt. You have to spin the ball with control in the right spot to have a reasonable birdie putt. That's why I think rough that tempted the pros to go for it or try to get the ball near the green would have, the scoring would have been almost the same, I think, because they would have run off the back of the green or run way to the side or, you know, God knows what, and still had chips.
Well, you may have seen the score at one under instead of five over. That's a possibility, I think, in my mind.
That may be, but, you know.
Well, yeah, and it would have been, I think, I agree completely with Jeff, and I think what it would have been a slightly different test of skill. Instead of seeing how you get, you know, how close you could hit a five iron to a green, you would have seen how close you could hit a wedge, you know.
Yeah,
it would have been a slightly different test.
I don't mind the U.S. Open being the tough one. My problem is when the Masters and the PGA start to look like the U.S. Open, and then we have three tough ones. So, you know, if you want to have one tough one per year, fine. It's the U.S. Open. The Masters should be a birdie eagle fest. The PGA should be, you know, 10 under or something. You know, there should be some birdies or eagles. And then British Open should be what it is. So, you know, I just have a problem with U.S. Open being it, but then the Masters and the PGA also being it.
Yeah, I agree with you, Eric.
The score is relative, so I don't care that it was five over. You know, make it a par 71 and the winning score was one over, you know? So who cares? Johnny Miller came out to the course, of course, you know, before play, reached 18 as they were cutting the 18th pin, got a standing ovation, of course, shot a 63 there in 1973 to win in the final round, threw his wallet down on the putting green, took a bunch of notes. Johnny Miller, of course, always does his homework, you know, was marking down where the pin would be, what the putts would do, so on. I made the comment that Paul Casey's 66 on Friday, which of course was Friday and not, you know, Sunday, was just as good a round of golf, you know, any circumstances notwithstanding. Obviously, again, it was Friday and not Sunday, as Miller's 63. And of course, Friday is the day I thought the course was perhaps set up the toughest. Jackie, disagree with that, but
yeah, I do. And the reason I disagree, Eric, I mean, not to say that it wasn't tremendous. It was obviously the best round of golf in the whole tournament. But what you say, you know, Friday versus Sunday, that's the complete demarcation.
Well, I'm talking about just the round of golf. Everything else aside.
Well, the other thing, I think the other measurement was that Miller's 63 was so much, was measurably lower than the field average for that
only 0.1.
Then was Casey's.
Only 0.1 lower. Miller's average was 72.9. Casey's average was 76.9. So it was 10.9 to 10.8 or something.
It was close, but it was better. And then, you know, and I can't discount the fact that that was Sunday and then Miller thought he was out of it. And, you know, playing with the clubs he played, forget the setup just for a second.
Well, the course is wet.
It was relatively the same length given the equipment. That was just bizarre. That was the work of a savant.
The idiot savant Phil Mickelson, of course, missed the cut due to Angel Cabrera's birdie on 9, his final hole on Friday. My friend and I were cheering when he had a sandwich, and we're like, "Birdie, come on!" And he did. And we're like, "Yes," you know. He put it to 2 feet, and we're like, "Bye, bye, Phil." And then, of course, Phil, you know, had to give his press conference that many thought was in poor taste to basically bash the USGA.
Well, it's difficult. It's disappointing to dream as a kid about winning the U.S. Open. And spend all this time getting ready for it, and have the course set up injure you. You know, it just and to think that you enter this tournament and you're not just trying to win and you're trying to hit great shots, but you're also trying to not end your career on one shot, which or at least suspend it for a while. That's a little disappointing. Yeah.
He said, you know, there's a potential for a career-ending injury, which, so far as I know, nobody's ever had at a U.S. Open. He said there's all this potential for players to injure themselves. Phil, of course, didn't injure himself during the tournament. He injured himself practicing for 1 hour around every green prior. David Howell withdrew during the tournament, and Anthony Lee, if I got the name right, I think, withdrew during the tournament due to injuries to the arm. Whether or not they were obtained at Oakmont or not is whatever. But there's no rash of injuries at U.S. Opens to wrists and stuff. And certainly, no one expects players or forces players to practice for an hour around every green. So while I agree with Phil's opinion, and we'll get your take on this here soon, while I agree with Phil's opinion that the rough should probably be, you know, a little bit lower. I mean, even Tiger said sometimes the grass wins. You just have to trust that the ball will come out and you'll be okay. Sometimes the grass wins. You know, I'd lower it again an inch, but that's not to prevent injuries, because I don't see injuries as a big problem. That's to encourage a little more shot making and risk taking. But again, like I said, a lot of people thought just the way he phrased it was just in poor taste, in missing the cut, practicing for an hour around every green, in saying, basically accusing the USGA of trying to end people's careers when that's what happened. Came off kind of funny.
The backstory there is that Phil was already injured, and so, you know, he was already, and we had some discussion about, you know, is it going to be legal for him to wear his brace? Okay, he already has a known injury, and he's coming in there, and I thought to blame the USGA for that or a potential, you know, listen, if Phil thought that Phil was going to get injured, then he should have stayed out of the tournament, as particularly if he thought it was a career-ending injury or potential there.
He injured it practicing out of rough that was twice as long because he thought that that's how long it was going to be, which doesn't make any sense. I mean, honestly, when have you ever seen the USGA play a US Open with foot-long rough around the greens? Never. I mean, they may be weird, they may be dumb sometimes, but there's no way he could have thought that that was the condition.
There's something, Eric, about it being a consequence of Dave Pelce wanting to gather data, and I'm curious how you heard that.
I know someone said that okay. Was Phil hitting so many shots around the greens was because Dave Pelz needs statistical evidence so he can tell Phil exactly where to put the ball and what kind of shot to hit from those lies. And you can't do that if you only hit two shots from each position. You know, right, significant number. Right, it does. But yeah, I mean, Phil went there, practiced at a rough that was a foot long or twice as long as, according to him, what ended up being, because he thought that's what it was going to be. And he spent 18 hours hitting, you know, thousands of shots around the greens, and that's how he injured himself. That's not tournament conditions, and that's not preparation. He's the only guy to do that. So his comments just came off a little funny.
I think they did. And then, you know, I'm a Phil fan, and I really like him and all of that. I thought the post, you know, miscut interview was a little weak, a little disingenuous, and not quite up to his normal high PR standard.
Well, go ahead.
By the way, I heard today that he pulled out of Hartford.
Yeah.
So, you know, he really is hurt.
There's no question that he was hurt. How he got hurt and who was to blame for it is what the problem I have with his statement is.
Yeah, and I thought it was in poor taste, but, you know, in Phil's favor, we hear a lot of sniveling from a lot of people at the U.S. Open every year. This is no different than any other year, and so Phil's comments joins the stream of sniveling that we hear every time because the USGA has teeth in their tournaments, and they are tough to play, and so that was just similar to what a lot of people were saying. Phil said it in a different way, but he said essentially the same thing. It was thick rough.
And Phil's won a PGA and he's won a Masters and he's played poorly at the British Open and he's never won but come close, of course, at the US Open. So I would expect more sniveling from Phil at the British Open, which we get, and at the US Open, which we get. So perhaps there's something to that as well. Final news here, our final discussion. We're done with the US Open stuff. And we're quick note on the LPGA's first major, the McDonald, whatever, at Bull Rock. it was a while ago. It was 2 weeks ago. Michelle, we made the cut on the number. She bogeyed the last hole, had a horrible tee shot way off to the right, made a bogey that she thought put her outside the cut, made the cut on the number, and then finished dead last. Shot like an 83 on Saturday and hacked it around on Sunday. And, you know, the eventual winner was
Suzanne Pettersen. The Norwegian.
Who did very well to win, held off a strong contingent of Kari Webb and a bunch of other strong contenders and players. Lorena Cho, of course, still majorless. But Michelle, we still, with the wrist injury, still what? She care about golf, or is BJ pissed her off enough that she doesn't get a rat's patootie?
I think she cares about golf. I think there's something still in her that loves the game. But I think that vigor that she once had is just going to be drained out of her. And the more that she finishes poorly like this, the more that she's going to play poorly. And, unfortunately, a girl of her age is going to be reading headlines. And I think that the media hit that she's taken for her performances in men's events and now in LPGA events, which is unfortunate for a gal who had a season like she had last year, real close to, quadruple crown. So it's really unfortunate to see her struggling like she is. And I personally, I pity her, but I think it's her parents that are kind of running the show there.
Jack, quick thought on Michelle?
Yeah, well, I think the pressure on Michelle Wie and her parents, thus the whole family, is just incredible because of the media backlash.
Wow.
And I think that, and I also think that she was, she's turning into a little bit of a snarky, denying kind of person, and I'm not real happy to see what I'm saying.
No, poor taste to stiff Annika Sorenstam the week before. Poor taste to go practice on the course before the other LPGA players were allowed to. Poor taste to do a lot of the things she did. So sad to see, and hopefully she can turn things around, both with her game and with her PR skills and attitude. So Tiger was, of course, number two in the last four majors. So he's got the top two slam going right now. Of course, twos really don't count for much. But in the stands, I did point out to the guys around me that people are always saying, yeah, but Jack had 19 second place finishes. So maybe Tiger's just chipping away at that.
Well, that's how I would look at it.
That about does it for episode 61 of the Golf Talk Podcast, brought to you by thesandtrap.com. You can check our show notes. There won't be any this week because we just talked about the U.S. Open, and you can find links about that anywhere. Every Wednesday at thesandtrap.com. Of course, check out our forum at thesandtrap.com/forum. For Jeff Smith and Jack Waddell, this is Eric Korzeski saying hasta la vista, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
See you next time.
Goodbye.